Thanks for joining us on Battle Walks as we walk across the great battlefields of Europe. If you're enjoying the show, why not become a member? Every week, you'll receive exclusive bonus episodes available only to subscribers, and you can listen to all our episodes completely ad-free. Click on the link in the show notes to join us via Acast Plus.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A Living History production.
I'm Matt McLaughlin.
And I'm Pete Smith.
We're battlefield historians who love nothing better than getting out and walking the ground where great battles in history took place.
And now we'd like you to come with us. Every week, Battle Walks will take you to one of the great battlefields of Europe.
As we walk the ground, we'll dig through the pages of history, we'll uncover the secrets of the battlefields, and most importantly, we'll tell the stories of the people who fought and died there.
Welcome to Battle Walks.
Hello and welcome to Battle Walks, where we are walking the great battlefields of Europe. This is a very special one this week because we're doing something a little bit different. And I've got to say, there's quite a tinge of jealousy in me here because my wonderful co-host Pete Smith is based in France and he lives in the battlefields. And so therefore, in spite of COVID, in spite of lockdowns, in spite of the dramas we've had over the last 18 months or so, Pete is still able to get out and walk the battlefields. He can't guide people, which I know is a huge source of frustration for him, but he can get out and walk the battlefields, and that's what we're going to be doing today, our first ever live walk of a battlefield. Sadly, I won't be there with him, but I'm looking forward to this, I think, just as much as you are to hear him walking around the battlefields. Pete, welcome back to the show. Tell us all about what we're doing today. It's really exciting.
Thanks, Matt. Great to be back again. Well, I just thought it was about time that we actually physically got out there. Now, it's a shame that you can't be with me, but I thought let's have a go at doing a live broadcast, per se, outside. So you'll hear the wind whistling around the mic, and we're going to be having a look at really just the fields around my village where I live, and the physical aspect of walking those fields. What do I do when I'm walking the fields, when I'm having a look, when I'm looking down, seeing if I can spot anything in the ground, when I'm looking up, just to give you a feel of what it's like literally walking on a battlefield.
The reason I'm so excited about this, Pete, is this is not a famous battlefield we're going to be walking. This is not the beaches of Normandy or the Waterloo battlefield or the opening day of the Battle of the Somme. This is just a field next to your house. And it just speaks to me so much about the history that is all around you there on the Somme. And that's why I'm so jealous. I would love to be able to walk out my front door and know that I'm standing in the middle of one of these historic battlefields.
Yep, the date is going to be the 16th of September in 1916. It's part of the Battle of the Somme. It's just a day like any other, a day really of horror, but of the ongoing attempt to push the Germans back, part of that overall Battle of the Somme. In fact, right in the middle, the day after this village where I live was taken by tanks on the 15th of September. So it's somewhere that I walk. And in fact, actually, I'm going to tell a story about what I find in this field. It's one I hadn't walked before. It was one I decided that I would just try a different field and go and have a look at what was in there, and also to get a feel of what it would have been like to have been attacking over that landscape. So that's what we're going to do.
Well, it's super exciting. Before we get into it, you're going to lead us off shortly, but before we do that, let's just talk about why we walk the fields. Why is it important to get out there and walk across the land?
Well, for me, it's something that I started doing when I was very young. In fact, at primary school, I had a headmaster who was very keen on local history. And on a Wednesday afternoon, he would take all the pupils at the school, myself and my fellow students, And we would be given a brown paper bag, as it was in those days, walk into the fields, lined up, and literally walk one side to the other. He'd obviously got permission from the farmer. Walk from one side to the other, and we had to pick up anything that we saw that we thought was interesting. Bits of pottery, marbles, just anything. Beads, just anything we saw, pop it in the bag. And then we went back into the school and we spent the next few days washing, cleaning, identifying, sorting any of the artifacts we found. And we used to find all sorts, from Roman bits and bobs to marbles from the children playing with them in Victorian times. Clay pipes, obviously the mainstay, and then things to do with the farming, horseshoes from the horses, just all sorts of bits and bobs, medieval pottery. A lot of it came from, I grew up in East Yorkshire, a little village on the outskirts of Hull, and it was called the night soil. In other words, all the rubbish and the refuse from the houses was put into carts and was taken out as fertilizer and dumped in the fields. And so this is what it was. It was the refuse from the city. So that really set me off on something that I continued even at that period. I would then go with my friends after school, and during the summer holidays we would walk the fields ourselves when the ploughing had taken place. And very soon I had a collection of all of these bits and bobs, clay pipes especially, all sorts of little bits of clay pipes. And it became something that really was in my blood, really. I'm a collector, I've always have been a collector, but it's that two things, it's touching history and collecting it just makes it so interesting. And as I grew older, I realised that research was the key. It's all right finding these things, but unless you can kind of put some kind of provenance to them, then it's just a thing. So research, finding out what was going on, why they were dumped in the fields, and eventually led me to finding the local dump, the Victorian dump for my village, where all the refuse and rubbish had been put in a wood, and this was the clue I should have realised years earlier, called Rat Wood. And of course it had rats in it because it had a lot of rubbish in it. And in that little wood of Rat Wood, I started digging up bottles, and I became for many years a very keen bottle collector, to such an extent that my father, when I went off to join the military, decided that I should sell them because he was worried about the attic having so many bottles inside that the ceilings were going to collapse in the house. So I had to sell most of my collection. I've still got a few about. But it's always been with me. So when I moved out here to France, I mean, I was aware that the detritus of battle would be all around in the fields around us. I had two teenage children at the time, and they were very keen to walk with me in the fields, especially my son. And we spent hours and hours, sometimes every day, going out exploring the area with our heads down. Not always. The key is to not just look at the ground to see what you can see, but it's to look up and to realise why it was there. And that's the great connection. It is when you find something, look around you and think, why is that there? Why is it here? And this is a story I'm going to be telling today, is the story of finding something in a field and then being able to build the whole story of why it was there.
Pete, I can't tell you how exciting I find that description, especially as an Australian. I think we have a broad range of listeners from across Europe and America and Canada and also throughout Australia. The Europeans just take it for granted that if you go for a poke around in your garden or the field next to your house, you will find everything from Roman coins to pottery to Victorian marbles. But for us Australians, it's just extraordinary. I was fortunate enough last year to go mudlarking down on the Thames when I was in London. Not last year, the year before. When I went, see, that's what COVID does to you. Time is starting to blur. It was the year before, not in 2019, when I was in London. I went mudlarking with Lara Meekham down there on the Thames, and just extraordinary. The idea that you can just walk around just picking up thousands and thousands of years of human history, quite extraordinary. But of course, on the First World War battlefields, it's very specific, the sorts of things you can discover in the stories that they tell. How do you stand on collecting artifacts from the battlefield?
Well, it's always interesting. Some people sit in the middle, some people absolutely against it, some people, like myself, don't find it an issue. I'll explain why I don't find it an issue, really. It's because that landscape, the surface area, the area that's been ploughed, has been ploughed for near on 100 years now. So it's been turned over constantly. So there's no context. It's not like an archaeological site where you want to preserve it. This layer of earth in the plough line has been turned over and over and over, and everything eventually will be destroyed. The modern mechanics of the ploughing itself, the harrowing, everything else that the farmers do, means that things are broken up and broken up and broken up, and just eventually will be smashed into such small pieces that you won't be able to ever identify what they are. So I'm looking in this area. I'm not digging. I'm not using a metal detector. I'm using the Mark One eyeball, and I'm looking down, and I'm just picking up things that are in this strata that is being constantly turned over. And so I have no qualms about picking things out of this strata. Now, I do have qualms about metal detecting and digging holes all over the battlefield, which sadly we do see occasionally. I think that's wrong. I think that shouldn't happen. But in an area where things are turned over, then I don't see an issue at all. And interesting, I got a little comment in my notes. I always carry some notes here, and I got a little comment about it's intermingled. Everything is intermingled. So it's not just I'm finding First World War relics. I'm also finding medieval relics. I'm finding Celtic relics. I'm finding lead seals from grain sacks. I'm finding whetstones for sharpening scythes. Again, clay pipes. They are the mainstay of the European fields. Shards of pottery. A Celtic bead. I've even found one Celtic bead. So you never know what you're going to find. And it is intermingled. That ploughing intermingles things as well. So there's no context. So it doesn't matter if you just pick them up. Obviously, the same as in the UK, if you find something of real historical significance, a hoard of coins or something, then you have to report it. But in the areas where I'm looking, it's been turned over. It's been turned over, in fact, by the shelling of the Great War and then the ploughing on top of it. So, no, I have no qualms about picking anything up in the fields at all.
It's a very interesting point, Pete, because as long as I've been visiting the battlefields, I've enjoyed picking up the occasional relic, especially if you go on a mission and you know you want to find the site where there was a machine gun post or the German front line used to be in the field. And if you then go and are successful in your mission, and then while you're there you find a couple of bullets or a badge or something like that, then absolutely. I've always found that a really enjoyable aspect of keeping those things. But a couple of things have influenced me over the years, and I'm not at all worried about this idea that people say, oh, if everyone takes something from the battlefields, there'll be nothing left. Perhaps in a place like Gallipoli, that's important. I know that when Charles Bean went to Waterloo as a young child in the 19th century, he was disappointed to see that there wasn't a single fragment of relic on the battlefield of Waterloo because it had been so picked clean in the previous 50 or 60 years. I'm not worried about that, particularly on the battlefields like the Somme. I'm not worried about people taking relics away or the historical importance of them. That's, as you say, that's not the case. There's no archaeological importance to any of these items. But a couple of things have influenced me over the years. The first one is I just started to have so much stuff that I was bringing home that it was getting difficult to remember. Everyone, you know, one bullet starts to look like the next. And I felt that I wasn't doing it justice. I suppose I could have had a better system of labeling, but I felt I wasn't doing it justice just to bring all this stuff home and then within a short period of time forget exactly where I found it. But the other thing is, of course, because we both work in the battlefield tourism industry, I had a number of run-ins and difficulties with people on tours, which encouraged me to start saying, in the end, after a few difficult and occasionally dangerous incidents, I then just started saying to people whenever I was on the ground, the easy thing to do was just say, look, don't touch anything. If you see something, we'll get a photo of it. You can take that home. I suppose that's been the other thing that's changed as well since I've been visiting the battlefields. We all now have a phone in our pocket. So in the old days, when I first started walking the battlefields, the only records you had of anything you found was what you took with you. What I've started doing these days is when I find interesting artifacts, collecting them together and taking a photo. And then I find that having a photo of these items is, to me, as good a record as actually having that item itself or potentially losing it in a drawer or something like that. And I have had several instances as well on tours where people have picked up grenades and other dangerous things. We had a school group where someone took a bullet home and the authorities in Dubai were not particularly keen on that person getting on the plane since they're carrying live ammunition. In fact, they were held in Dubai and they missed their flight because they had a bullet in their bag. So yeah, that has influenced me as well. To just sort of this sort of blanket decision not to take anything from the battlefields. But I would say to people, as long as you know what you're doing, as long as you're being safe and not picking up grenades, and things that can still cause you some nasty injuries. There is nothing wrong when you walk the battlefields taking a relic or two. Bearing in mind, it is illegal. Technically, it is illegal. The French do say you're not supposed to take things from the battlefield. So, you know, a few different variables around there. But I think particularly for you, Pete, living in that area, walking that ground, just a wonderful connection with the history to find those little bits and pieces.
Yeah, generally speaking, I don't touch munitions of any type because I don't need to. I know what they are. There's no point. I'm talking even about spent cases, the cartridges from the rifles, completely safe, but there's no need to. And I do leave them there. It's really the more personal items that I feel that I'm saving, really. I enjoy archaeology. I did do some archaeology when I was younger, and I just think it's necessary to pick these things up that are going to, you know, they won't survive, and so I don't have any qualms about picking them up at all. You're absolutely right. Places like Gallipoli, that's not quite the same because that is a preserved battlefield. Nobody's been ploughing there since the fighting took place. Just animals grazing, goats and things. So that is different. And I would be not take anything from Gallipoli. And again, it's illegal. You're not allowed to anyway. But I wouldn't want to because that is a preserved landscape. This is not a preserved landscape. This is a farming landscape. It always makes me smile. The farmers will come across and tell you where the best place is to go looking, because they think we're all idiots, you know, and we're taking lumps of metal and things out of their fields that they're quite happy to be removed, because there's an awful lot in the field. So it's not a problem here at all. It is. Yes, you do have to be careful with munitions, and certainly when I take my clients from the battlefield, I normally say don't touch anything if they want to. Occasionally, I'm on a private tour and we're in a field where a relative has been lost. They want to find something to take back from that that field. Sadly, of course, Australians can't take the soil back because people generally from the UK or from even from America, they will have a little vial and they will put in it some soil from the battlefield, but Australians can't. So next best thing, a little lead shrapnel ball. It looks like a marble, is normally the thing that I will hand out to people if they want to take something back from that field, and they're very easy to find. But occasionally you do find a button or something that's a little bit more personal, and I will always hand that over to my client as well. So I think it's you just have to be careful. You have to be a little bit knowledgeable about what you're looking at. And but other than that, it's not dangerous, and it's very, very interesting, as you'll see from the rest of this podcast.
Well, Pete, I'm super excited. Let's get out there. Let's go walking. What a privilege this is for our listeners to walk the battlefields with Pete Smith. I'm jealous that I'm not there with you, mate, but let's get out and walk that field.
Wish you were with us, Matt. So off we'll go.
Welcome to the first of our outside recordings. I'm just leaving my house in the village of Flares and heading down through the village towards the famous to me anyway, memorial to the 41st Division. It's the figure of a British Tommy on top of a plinth. He's looking up the street, perhaps he's waiting for the tanks to come and support him. On the 15th of September, this is where tanks first went into action for the first time. So we're passing him, giving him a nod as we walk past. And then we're going to head east, turning right. This road I've always known as Bull's Road, but in doing the research for this this podcast, I've realised that it's not called Bull's Road. The proper name for it is Rue de Gardecourt, so Gardecourt Road. And that's where this road leads to now. At the time of the First World War, this road was actually going to a place called Le Bouf, the beef, so hence the name Bull's Road. So we're just leaving the... starting to leave the last of the houses behind us. And we're now entering a sunken road. So we have banks on both sides, one of the famous sunken roads of the Somme battlefield for this region, very, very common. But of course, used throughout the whole of the war as a place of shelter for both sides. Also a place of danger, because on the trench maps they were marked, so always places that had a double edge to them. Safety, but danger from shelling, the enemy shelling them. We're going down a gentle slope and into a valley. Only a gentle valley. Walking up the other side, and as we start to climb the other side, where we can see a cross of sacrifice. Cross of Sacrifice, one of those features of all of the Commonwealth War Graves cemeteries. Quite a substantial cross with a sword emblazoned on one side of it. That sword represents a Crusader sword. So what we're going to do is we're going to just walk in through the entrance and find a place to sit down. And just on the steps, I think. And then we'll have a chat about where we're going next. I'm just walking across to the steps. Okay. So, in a minute we're going to head further along Bull's Road, heading further out of the village into the open fields. And in fact, Bull's Road marks the extent of the success on the 15th of September 1916. This is where the attacking troops in this area got to. They got to the edge of the road here and dug in here. But that's not going to be the end of the battle. The battle intends to get all the way to Gerdecourt, which is a village on our left-hand side, just out of sight. If we look directly in front of us from the front of the cemetery where we're sitting, then we can see that Bull's Road continues to climb. Well, on top of that, the highest points, which we're going to go past in a second, that's where there was a German artillery position. This was taken out by tanks on the 15th of September, and was a German strong point. So we're going to walk past that, and we're going to walk down the other side and to where Bull's Road takes an extreme sharp 90 degrees left-hand turn. But in fact, it didn't. In 1914-18, so during the war and presumably after the war at some stage, it went straight on and it went straight to Le Bouff. It doesn't any longer. It's now a ploughed field, but you can still clearly see the route of the road. It's left an imprint in the landscape. And that's the field that we're going to walk in. So what we'll do now is we'll stand up and we'll head on walking up the road again. So off we go. So up the hill, past this position that had an artillery piece, or several, it was a battery, several guns here. In fact, there's an interesting little story here. The tanks overran this position, but tanks are not good. You can't get out of a tank and capture the Germans, at making sure that the Germans are either dead or have surrendered. And the tanks drove over here, the guns went underground, and they actually came out again. And as the tanks came back, as they developed problems, remembering this is the first day of the use of tanks, these guns actually were manned again and waited for the tanks to come back past them, and actually successfully knocked out one of the tanks as it headed back to its start point. And they had to wait for the infantry before this position was completely cleared. Another little by-the-by, one of my friends has one of the dial sights from one of these guns. It was souvenired by an officer, and he was lucky enough to actually to pick it up in an auction, so very jealous, I quite like that. So we're now heading down to that 90 degree turn on the road, and we're going to stop here again. We can't walk into the field. This is May, where we're recording this in the May. The field is now ploughed and seeded, and in fact in this case it's not seeded, it's got potatoes in. So we can't walk in between the ridges of the potatoes. But when I walked here, and this is what we're going to be talking about, when I walked here in March, a few months previously, then very different. We could walk into the field. It was rough ploughed. It had had two or three months of rain and frost and weather on it, and which meant it was ideal for having a look and getting the feel of what went on in this area. So I'm just going again. We're going to find somewhere. We're going to sit on the bank here, and we'll tell you exactly what went on and what I discovered here 2 months ago. Just plonk myself down again. So, so how do I walk a field? Well, to start off with, you don't go galloping about quickly. You walk into the field, and I put my head down straight away, and I just look at the ground, very carefully looking at the ground, because you're looking for very small things, really. These are not big things. I'm ignoring the shells, which you do come across, and you've definitely ignored those, and other munitions. I'm looking for just the small things. But what you have to do is every now and then you lift your head up to look exactly where you are to see what's around you. So I walked up the road, which is directly in front of us. It's no longer a road, the old Bull's Road. There's a bank on the left-hand side. And I decided just to scramble up this bank. It's not a steep bank, so scrambling's not a very good word. It gives the wrong impression. I walked up this bank slowly. And I stopped at the top because I started seeing a lot of fired British cartridges. Now, that's unusual. So why is it unusual? Well, you have to think about the mentality of an infantryman when he's attacking. He leaves the safety of his trench. He's got to cross no man's land. And he wants to get across no man's land as quick as he can. He's going to perhaps have one round, well, certainly have one round in the breech, so the weapon is cocked and ready to just a squeeze of the trigger and off it goes. But he doesn't want to fire it unless he can see somebody to fire at. And in most cases, you have to say, as they cross no man's land, they see very little. And so he would have crossed no man's land, possibly a Mills bomb in one hand, and as he got to the German trench, he threw your Mills bomb. The Mills bomb explodes. You go to the lip of the trench, look down, fire your rifle at the nearest German, jump into the trench, and then it's bayonet work, that nasty part of the fighting of the First World War. And so it's very unusual to actually find the rounds in the field. So here we are on this lip of the highest point almost of this sunken road, the bank on the left-hand side. I know the German front line is about 300 metres beyond this lip, and where the soldiers had come from is about 100 metres to our right, the other side. So I'm very firmly in no man's land, in the centre of no man's land. So I bend down and I have a look at the cartridges, I pick one up just to, I don't normally take cartridges home. You can have too much of a good thing. There's very little point in taking fired cartridges home. And it puzzles me because there are so many of these cartridges lying around. So I then move a little bit further and again, more cartridges and some little pieces of metal that I know from experience what they're coming from. They're coming from a magazine from a Lewis gun that's been left in the fields here. And that gives me a clue that this is where a Lewis gun was in action. It explains why there were so many rounds fired here. A little further, looking down. And now I'm looking very closely at this little patch of land, because when you know that a soldier's been fighting here, then this is where you're liable to perhaps find something else. And the first thing that I find here, which is fairly unusual, I've only found three or four in all of the 20 years that I've been here, and that's part of a belt from what's called the 1914 leather equipment. Now, the 1914 leather equipment was emergency issue of infantryman's, it's the belt that he carries his ammunition in for his rifle. And this is the clasp, it's called an S-clasp, a snake clasp. And this is the clasp, and it's got quite a bit of leather still attached to it. So an unusual find, and one that certainly I will keep. And so I pop that into a little bag, and I normally carry a little bag with me. I'm actually walking up and down the road as I'm talking. I find it easier to do that. So if you're wondering what the noise is, me walking. And again, looking very careful to see what else I can spot. And I find something that really I find extraordinary. And it's the personal belongings of the men that fought here. And this is a little tiny bit of silvery looking material. It's actually aluminium. It's a little small aluminium tin that's been crushed flat, and I can hold it in the palm of my hand. And when I look carefully, I can actually, even 100 years later, I can read a little bit of lettering on it, and it says Shaving S. Now, the S would have stood for stick, so it's shaving stick. So what is that? Well, in the days when cutthroat razors were being used, it's where the soap was inside the shaving stick. It was protected with this little aluminium tube. You pushed it out, you rubbed your shaving brush on there with your badger, I think in those days they had badger fur bristles, you got up a lather and onto your face, and then with your cutthroat razor. So it's a very personal piece of kit that would have come out of a soldier's small pack on his back. Unusual, actually, because very often if they were just in an attack and going into action for a couple of days, then they weren't really expected to shave. But here it is in the field, so this man had obviously carried it. And that makes you start thinking, would you leave this in the fields? Would you just throw it away? Well, no, you wouldn't. That means that somebody's small pack has been here in the fields. I found cutthroat razors in the past because they have bone handles, and quite often they're a nice thing to find because the soldiers actually burnt their initials and numbers onto the handles. So that's always a very rewarding when you can actually tie something to an individual. Now, I've only ever done that a couple of times in the 20 years, so it's very unlikely that we'll find anything here, or that I would find anything here 2 months ago. So on again, a little bit further, and we find the things that you normally expect to find. More buckles from soldiers' equipment, a button. Now, I always find the buttons very emotive, really. This is a general service button. We've been on the tunic of a soldier who fought here. And I like it in the sense because you know that the last time he touched that button, that would have been the last person that touched it before I picked it up out of the fields. And it gives you a little thrill, really, to know that hopefully he lived, but he's just lost the button. But the last time he touched that button, the last person to touch that button before you picked it up was the soldier himself. So I quite like that connection, and it's one of the reasons why I do what I do, really. It gives you more of a connection. Now, what is becoming obvious to me as I'm walking down following this top of this bank, I look up and I look to the right, and I can see from where I am that there's a position that I know quite well. It's on the road, and that's where the German trench ran. Here, we're lucky, the German trench runs right along the new road to Gerdecourt, so we know exactly where it was. It was called the Gerd Trench, G-I-R-D, if anybody wants to look on the trench maps. And it's the trench that's just in front of a place called Gerdecourt. And no doubt I'm saying that wrong, as you know, for those that have listened to these podcasts before, my pronunciation of French village is not brilliant. Let's stick to Gerdecourt. And there's a point on this road called Point 91, and it's where there was a Maxim gun position there. Now, once I get the feel of the landscape, and that's why you need to look up and look round, you realise that where all this debris, all of these bits and pieces from the soldiers' equipment and from their lives on the Western Front, why is it here? Well, it's here because this is where you could be seen by the German machine gunner. So as they crested this little bank, then they become very visible to the German machine gunner there away on our right-hand side, about 300-400 metres away. 300 metres. It becomes obvious that what's going on here, well, not obvious, you have to just think about it a bit. What's going on here is this is men going to ground because they're taking very heavy fire. So in other words, some of them will be hit, some of them are falling down, and some of them are actually diving to the ground. And I suspect this is where we found all the Lewis gun rounds, this light machine gun, the Lewis gun, when it opens fire from that position to try and counter the machine gun fire coming from the right flank. So, again, carry on walking this line, knowing now a little bit more about why this line is here. Because this is me, this is exploring. I've never walked this field before, so this is all new. Of course, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take back all the information that I glean from literally walking the fields and look at the trench maps and get the diaries out and try and figure out what went on here. One of the things I do know is that this is the 14th Division that is fighting here. It was known as the Light Division. So one of the divisions of the British Army here, 14th Division, this is where they're fighting on the 15th and 16th of September in 1916. And then I find something that's really going to be the clue. And what it is, it's the remnants of a shoulder title. So what's a shoulder title? Well, it's in brass, it's on the shoulder of every single British soldier, and it tells you what regiment they are. And in this case, I have no idea, because it's crushed, and it's broken, it's only a fragment of one, and what I can see are the letters M-E-R. And M-E-R is very difficult to work out what that could possibly be, especially since I can tell it's from the middle. And so I pop that in my bag, and I will look at that when I get home. But that is going to be the clue that will tell me which battalion, which regiment it is that's fighting at this location. And then a few more buckles, a few more bits and pieces. It's about 2 hours this was, so it makes it sound in the 10, 15, 20 minutes that I'm describing it. It makes it sound as if I hadn't been here very long, but I had. I'd been here for about 2 hours. And I head back. What I'd done, which is odd for me, I suppose, really, is inadvertently, without thinking, I had picked up one of the fired cartridges. Completely safe, it's just an empty cartridge, and I just popped it in with the rest of the bits and pieces that I'd picked up. One of the first things I do when I get home is I wash and clean and dry, and if it's bits of leather, I try and put some leather soap or something in to stop them from going hard and falling to pieces. And I also make sure that I keep things together so I know what day and where I was, because that's the whole point of these things. They have to have a context. If you don't have a context, there's very little point in collecting them. And this cartridge case that I'd picked up, and who knows why I'd picked this one up, it had something inside it. I could hear it rattling. And so I carefully washed it and I gave it a shake. And out popped, and I just found this absolutely extraordinary, out popped a pencil. So this cartridge case had not been used, or it had been used, obviously, to hold a bullet at one stage. It had been fired, a soldier had picked it up, he had a stub of a pencil. And this is an indelible pencil, and that's what most soldiers wrote with. In other words, it's not quite, in fact, I have no idea what an indelible pencil actually is, that what causes it, but effectively it makes your pencil so it doesn't, you can't rub it out. It's like ink, and indelible pencils are, as those who've listened to podcasts before will realise, that I collect memorabilia of the Great War, and my favourite collecting theme are postcards and photographs, and very often they are written on the back in this indelible blue, it's always blue pencil. So to find this inside a bullet, and you know exactly what's happened, it's become a stub, so it's hard to hold. So what the soldier has done is pushed it into a bullet to give him just that extra few weeks of writing. And to me, to find something so personal, you know, I look at it and I can see that he sharpened it with a penknife, not obviously a modern pencil sharpener. So that's his strokes, his cuts in the wood of a man that sharpened this before he went into action and then had it with him in his equipment. It may be from the same man that had the shaving brush. I don't know, we never will know. But to find something so personal, I suppose, to me, that is why I do this. That's why I walk the fields, because you learn and you feel a great connection to the men who fought here. So, what are we going to do now? Well, I'm going to head back towards the cemetery, because I'm going to sit down again. And so we're walking back up the hill away from the field where I found these interesting artifacts. And of course, what I did next, I got my books out. I looked up M-E-R. What does M-E-R stand for? Well, it's the middle of the word Somerset. So what do I know? Well, immediately I know this is the Somerset Light Infantry. So where I'm walking is where one battalion of the Somerset Light Infantry fought. Now, I'm lucky, I've got a nice substantial library. And I've got the history of the Somerset Light Infantry in the First World War. So all I do is I open up that date. Lots of battalions, but there'll only be one battalion that fought there, and it was the 6th Battalion. So the 6th Battalion fought here. They fought here on the 16th of September in 1916. So I'm just going to plonk myself down. Now, you're going to hear some rustling now, because I'm going to get my notes out for this, because I need to look at those... Right, so here we go. So this is the story taken from a combination of their war diary and various other books of what happened to them on that day, on the 16th of September. But we're going to start a little earlier than that. So we're going to start on the 14th of September. And this is where they'd been resting. They'd been resting at a place called Selincourt, which is near Amiens behind the lines. And they then got word that they were needed at the front again, and they headed towards the front. On the 15th of September, they were issued their bombs and flares and small arms ammunition. And they would have dropped off their large packs, fastened on their small packs. That's for fighting order, for going into action. And they're going to occupy the trenches close to where I find the artifacts. But before there's a route that they have to come in through, Bernafay Wood, Delville Wood, through the switch line that had been captured on the 16th, so the day before. So you can imagine they're crossing a place which would not be pleasant. There would still be a lot of bodies lying about. It wouldn't have been cleared properly. In fact, one of their jobs as they cross this landscape would be to make sure that there were no Germans still loitering anywhere. And they're going to move into a series of captured trenches known as Double A and Double B. These are not exciting names. I have to say, for trench names, I feel like making something up and calling them something else. But in all of the diaries, they're marked as Double A and Double B. On the 16th of September, they move into the front line, and they're not happy. The weather's not particularly brilliant, and no rations have arrived, so they've not been fed. So they're expected to use their iron rations, their emergency rations, which every soldier carries with them. The big problem is a lack of water, so not a lot of water. At 4:30, their Lieutenant Colonel, who was called Lieutenant Colonel Ritchie, he's ordered to attack at 9:25. So this is 4:30. They're in the front line. It's still dark. 9:25, it will just be coming. Well, it'll be daylight for about an hour and a half, 2 hours. So it's going to be a daylight attack. Now, that is not long enough for them to know anything. They've not been here before. They know nothing about what's in front of them. They've not had a chance to reconnoitre the ground. And so it's already, you can see, lack of food, not being fed, long marching, no time to have a look at what's in front, expected to go straight into action. So I'm going to just explain where the different companies are. B Company was on the right, C Company in the middle, and A Company on the left. Now, that is from the direction of if we were in the sunken road where we've just been, imagined that we walked where I walked 2 months ago, then that's behind us. So they're going to be crossing over the sunken road as they attack. So at 6 o'clock, the artillery opens fire, and it's described as desultory and too scanty. And it slackens and then stops just after 9 o'clock, remembering that they're going to be attacking at 9:25. Now, I may not have said that already, but they're going to be attacking at 9:25. So at 9:25, there's no artillery support. There's been very little. There's no creeping barrage. There's nothing to aid them in their attack, which there should have been, because by now we are using the creeping barrage, but no barrage to protect them as they advance. And oddly, they have another odd thing. Their trench doesn't line up exactly with the German trench they're going to attack. And so as they climb out of their trench, they have to do a half right incline. So it's called a right incline. In other words, they turn half right. And that means that the obviously direction is a bit of a problem. If you're doing that and you don't know quite where you're going, and then you have to do a half right turn before you head off to advance, then already we're losing cohesion. Men are not staying directly in the lines. They're going to go over in two waves from each company, and almost immediately they start to taking fire. But the heavy fire is going to arrive, as we suspected from the walk that I did, as they drop down into this little sunken road, or what's left of it, the old Bull's Road, as they climb up the bank on the other side, and they get spotted by the German machine gunners at point 91. And it's called enfilade fire. It's coming in from their flank, and it's going to do terrible damage to the attacking companies, who some of them go to ground there, again, as we suspected, and open fire. Others continue on, heading towards the Gerd line, and that's their objective. Now, there's another complication. There is a trench that's in between this position on this little ridge and the Gerd trench that they didn't know about. And they think that that trench is the Gerd line. And so they attack that. There are Germans in it, not many, and they successfully kill or capture quite a few. And so they think they've done their business. Very heavy casualties already, but they think they've done their business. It's not until that evening, to around about 6 o'clock, that they realise that they're not in the right place. And when Lieutenant Colonel Ritchie, the commanding officer, realises, he knows that that's not good enough. They will have to try and take the Gerd line, and so they try to advance towards the Gerd line. And again, just appalling casualties. So the Brigadier General, the Brigadier of this brigade, he sends a message urging both battalions to hold where they are. And the 6th Somersets, they already have taken 350 casualties. I'm going to do the complete casualty figures when we get to the end. But 350 casualties, 350 men from an attacking force, is an enormous number of men. The King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, also the 6th Battalion, comes up to support them. They're in close support, and they are also taking very heavy casualties. And it very quickly becomes obvious that they're not going to be able to move further forwards. And the following day, on the 17th of September at 5:30, having spent the night there just trying to hold on to where they are withdrawn from the line along with the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry. They then walk back across the old battlefield of the day before until they get to a location called Pommiers Redoubt. Now, Pommiers Redoubt is a very famous location. It's almost worth a podcast in its own right. But they get to Pommiers Redoubt, well behind the firing line now, had been a German strong point, where they have the roll call, where they call the roll. And it's just appalling. Of the officers that attacked, there were 17 officers in the attack that took place. All of them are casualties. So there are no officers that have come back at all from the action. Three of them were killed, 12 were wounded, and two are missing. Of the other ranks, everybody else, the non-officers, 387 have become casualties, of which 41 were killed, 203 were wounded, and 143 are missing. So that means that the battalion is ineffective. The battalion will have to be taken out of the line and rebuilt. There's not enough men there to make them practical in any form on the battlefield until they've been had men replacing those casualties. The sad aspect, and it is sad, I think, is that most of those that died that day have no known grave. So they're on the Tietvall to the missing of the Battle of the Somme. We can, the Tietvall Memorial carries all of their names. There's a cemetery that we can see from this position. From, if we went back onto their battlefield, we can actually see a cemetery. It's called the Guard Cemetery Les Bouffes. And 10 of the men of the 6th Somerset Light Infantry, then they are actually buried in the Guard Cemetery at Les Bouffes. And I think that's quite fitting, as if we want to, and I have done, we can go and visit their graves. So that's it. Just a little story about walking the battlefield and what you gain from walking the battlefield. I hope you've enjoyed it. We intend to record a few more of these of actually out on the ground for you. I hope you've enjoyed it, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you would like to support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do it. Firstly, you can become a member. For a small monthly fee, you can subscribe to the show and listen to every episode ad-free, and also receive exclusive episodes directly from Pete and I. So see the link in the show notes to sign up at Acast Plus and become a member of the show. Also, if you want to make a one-off contribution, you can now buy us a coffee. Visit buymeacoffee.com/battlewalks and you can make a small contribution there. See you next week.